Blog Talk Radio.
This is Graphic Policy Radio, where comic books and politics meet the multiverses. I'm Brett, one of your hosts, and I believe this is a...
Hi, Alana. It's Elon 11.
Hey, how you doing? Perfect timing.
Good to be back. I'm glad we can do some coverage from Comic-Con.
Yeah, definitely interested to hear what you had to say. It was, I think we might as well dive right into that. So it was an interesting perspective from me going to New York Comic Con, because I also went to San Diego this year. So comparing the two shows was really interesting. But what are your thoughts? What was the cool stuff you saw, panels you went to, stuff like that?
Well, the things I thought were most useful were the press sessions that I went to with some writers of some of the best shows on television, by which I mean Adventure Time, The Venture Brothers, and The Regular Show. I attended the big X-Men mega panel, as well as the Let's Explain to Didio and Lee Once Again Why They're Clueless panel, which was less painful than I feared, in part because the audience put some good questions to them. It wasn't all left to us to question them about what they'd done. I unfortunately missed the Bat Family panel, which I'd really wanted to go to because, as I think a lot of folks have seen online, Amy Reeder, who I think is one of the best artists working in comics, period, and one of the best artists working in comics for a very long time, was ousted from the Batman comics panel because they didn't have room for her, apparently, was their argument. Which
How hard is it to bring up another chair?
I know, and she couldn't be that large, right? I mean, it's like, we're having a diversity problem. Let's remove the one woman from the panel. So that, to me, was just, like, stupid and a loss, especially since she's so talented. And, oh, yeah, you guys have a woman problem, so why don't you have her be there? I actually wasn't able to attend as much as the convention as I'd wanted to this year on account of Occupy Wall Street. I was really busy, and I had less time to occupy Comic-Con, but I did find that there was certain similarities between the two, namely that, you know, people have a shared interest in Guy Fawkes masks and in creative personal expression. So
it was interesting. I was watching a lot of the Twitter feed as I was running around, and it seemed a lot of the artists and a lot of people that were attending Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con, was also at the protests for Occupy Wall Street. Like, as they were going to the con, they would stop off at Occupy Wall Street for a little while and then head over to the con.
Oh, I missed that. I wish I could have done that. I know Rushkoff went by.
Yeah.
Molly Crabapple has been down there a lot doing drawings of the protests and doing fundraisers. I mean, she's like a huge supporter of Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, I see her on Twitter all the time talking about it.
But I don't know if I've seen other people down there. I guess I just have bad timing.
Yeah,
I want to thank my comic book fans for not unfollowing me because of my on Twitter because of my constant Occupy Wall Street tweets. I definitely think it goes to show to the multifarious interests of people in this community, though, that folks seem to be interested in hearing about both of these subjects.
So the other one that was interesting was it was one of those, I don't know if I'm just paying more attention to it now, but walking around the con, like, it was all union guys working the convention, and I guess it's the same at pretty much every convention center.
Javits is a union shop.
Yeah, well, most of them are. When talking to a lot of the publishers as they go, they kind of talk about, like, oh, you know, you have to deal with the union guys and blah, blah, blah. And it's just kind of fun listening to them on the back end talk about that stuff. But it was one where I was, like, really kind of paying attention for the first time and just noticed it. I don't know if it was just they were more apparent, because a lot of them were wearing their shirts that had, like, the union listed.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if people were trying to be more visible on purpose for that, because there definitely have been a ton of great folks from every union down on Zuccotti Park that I've seen. So they actually have a special pile of hard hats down there to represent whichever, you know, union guys who work in the trades that happen to be down there that day. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Although, actually, you know, we should totally talk about, and I didn't have a chance to bring this up at the X-Men panel, and we haven't spoken about it yet, is the Richter union busting an X-Factor last year. That was...
Yeah.
Did you guys do that last week while I was gone?
No. I mean, we weren't on the air last week, and then the week before was me rambling for an hour. It was really a long ramble. No, we actually haven't discussed that. I mean, so we talked about
let's be sure to hit on that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's definitely framed in the comic as something which he's doing because they need money. So I feel like, on the one hand, the comic does make, sort of posits itself as making the argument that the union should, workers should take lower rates because their work can be done more cheaply by one lone metahuman than it could by, than it could be, you know, by a union team. You don't get the sense that Richter is, like, proud for union busting. But it also, I also didn't feel like the, I did feel that the writer's angle on the story was that having a larger, you know, that the union workers were obsolete in the face of the metahuman person.
Well, it was interesting was when I first read it, so there's, like, a throwaway line from the business guy that's like, I can't afford to pay you what you guys want. I had to do this. Like, it's a really quick line, and it's just like, all right, that's really odd. And there's definitely the sense that X-Factor doesn't really want to do it, but they need the money. My bigger thing is, like, I haven't read this week's issue of X-Factor, so I haven't seen if it's referenced at all, but it was just really out of place. Like, it'd be one thing if it was some sort of ongoing thing where either they're taking up jobs that they're not proud of, or there's some further thing of that storyline, but it was just like one done and that was it. And that was kind of the only thing with me where I kind of shook my head, like, what was this about? Like, it just seemed
weird. That's a good point. It seemed like it was coming, supposed to be from that narrative, but then it actually wasn't. I felt like the comic did not seem to, like, understand these things. And, you know, I don't like when people try to play it against, like, oh, like, as if the ununion workers are, like, assholes. No, usually they're people who are just really, really desperate. They're doing the wrong thing. I don't think people should break picket lines. I'm a union person, like, professionally. But it's not, in most cases, the workers who are doing it, they're, like, they're just as screwed over as the next guy. It's management who shouldn't be, you know, putting people in those situations. But I don't know. It was definitely weird. I do think that question of, you know, what do you do when you have people who, it's like talking about automation, really, as an equivalent, is an interesting thing to handle in comics. I didn't think that was a particularly good exploration of it, maybe.
My only other thought on it is that, like, Richter got his powers back in Avengers Children's Crusade, and they hadn't addressed it yet. Like, that was the first issue where he had his powers back, so it needed to be addressed somehow, and it needed to be shown off somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to what I think the point of the scene was, but it's just really out of place. It was odd. Like, that's the only thing I could say. It just did not feel, it didn't fit the feel of the comic. It was out of place. It just didn't drive any narrative whatsoever other than, hey, Richter's got his power back, and they're doing jobs they don't like. And that was about
it. Yeah, I mean, I felt like it was interesting. I mean, I guess, in a sense, everybody kind of looks bad in that issue. But I did still sort of feel your takeaway was supposed to be that the union guys were supposed to, like, because I think that Peter David, like most people who don't deal with unions intimately, don't understand, expecting them to literally break their contract, which they can't do, rather than renegotiating something if they don't have the money. It's like, basically, look, there's a lot of people who don't have a lot of knowledge about unions. Unfortunately, these days, people don't learn about them in school. There are majority of the population aren't in unions anymore because of government actions that have made it harder for people to form unions. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people who don't really know anything about it. And, I hope that we have an opportunity to educate people more, especially since, we've been recently learning about some working conditions at Marvel that make it certainly seem like a very appetizing target for union organizing over there with the one bathroom per gender for 100 staff people. Like, can I transition that over there?
I was about to say, that's a fantastic transition. I have to applaud that.
I had Brett, with his rocket research skills, as soon as we both read this article on Comics Beat that talks about how Marvel has one bathroom for men, one bathroom for women, for the entire staff, and people actually schedule their lunch breaks and shifts so they can use the bathroom. Brett ran over, looked it up on OSHA, and found out that, yes, Marvel is in violation of occupational safety and health laws. So I wrote something up for Graphic Policy. Folks should go check it out on the blog.
I think it's the most popular article this week. It's getting a hell of a lot of hits.
Oh, that's great. It's so disgusting. I don't know if this is a long-standing thing that they don't have enough restrooms or if this is something that the new boss has brought in. I'd love to talk with anybody off the record, if anyone's listening, who's worked in the Marvel offices who can talk with me about the internal working conditions to see if that little sweatshop bathroom issue is new to Perlmutter or if the building has always been that way. But you deserve more bathrooms so that people don't have to base when they go on their lunch break on when they can have a most likely slot to pee. It really seems like a highway to urinary tract infections to do it this way.
So,
be good for the long-term health of the company. People have to go get antibiotics all the time and go to doctor's appointments.
And antibiotics make you go to the bathroom more, which is even more self-defeating. Maybe this is why Marvel.
Good point.
And maybe this is why Marvel's a lot of things are late, because everyone's going to the doctor.
Out your problems. There you go.
So for people who don't know, Marvel laid off about 26 people this last week, give or take. They've been laying off people for about the last month or so. And part of the story that came out, there was this anecdote, whether or not it was tongue-in-cheek or whether or not it was serious or just, I've never been in their offices, so I don't know, but they said that there's one bathroom for men, one bathroom for women for like 100-something people. And, so I don't know why out of that article this is what I focus on. It's not the people losing their jobs. It's the there's two bathrooms.
Well, unfortunately, people getting laid off of jobs while working for a profitable company that could afford to keep them on is very common. That's why it didn't stand out to you, Brett. In fact, it's been happening at all the banks who took bailout money. They were very profitable, took tons of bailout money. Then they went ahead and laid off their employees. Same thing happened at Verizon. Verizon is cutting off of benefits. That's why the workers went on strike there for a while. So you probably noticed the bathroom thing specifically because that is more unusual.
Yes.
Whereas, sadly, the layoffs, the completely useless, destructive, not necessary layoffs are very normal.
And,
I just hope we can bring a little bit of the Occupy Wall Street sentiment to Marvel offices and, help people think of some creative ways to respond to this. It's really, really sad. I feel horrible for all the folks who've lost their jobs.
Well, coming out of it is the Occupy Marvel and the anti-street gang who's kind of taking them on.
That's my goal. If anybody feels like signing up to join the to represent the good working people of Yancey Street and stand up to Wall Street, pop me over an email.
So it's interesting on the whole Marvel layoffs. So my take on it is Isaac Perlmutter, who was the owner of the company, is a notorious penny pincher. And to the point that he keeps, like, no back stock. It's, like, print-to-order sort of stuff that, if a comic's sitting on the shelf in their warehouse, that's money that's wasted. That's the bottom line he's looking at. There's reports that, he wants to be the go-between between Marvel and Disney, who bought them out for, like, $4 billion. He made out like a bandit in that deal. He's also out of that the largest shareholder after Steve Jobs, so now I guess he's the largest shareholder of Disney. And that he's angling
for Disney has the money. Has the money. They have no need to lay people off. And if they want to have a long term investment in creating characters that people will want to spend tons of money and merchandising and in movies in, then they should keep their creative folks employed there to come up with this.
And that's what's interesting is that reading from the reports is that a lot of it's looking at, like, how are the comics themselves doing, not this comic, Captain America spun out a movie, X-Men spun out a movie. Like, they're not looking at it as an idea shop. They're looking at it as, like, a bottom line so that, your toys based off of this comic might be selling like gangbusters, but that has no impact on the fact that – on how they perceive the comic is doing. So
–
It's they're not looking at the big picture. It's really isolated the small things. So they're looking at like, okay, this comic's doing bad, and perceived on the bottom line of this is how many it's selling, this is how much it costs, it's not worth it. But they're not also looking at that, hey, this cartoon character is based off of storylines directly coming out of this comic or this toy is based off of storylines directly from the coming from the comic. That part of the whole like idea publish, you know, the idea factory isn't factored into how profitable a comic line is or a series is. So, I mean, they just announced they're axing like four or five different series. Iron Man 2.0 is going. Alpha Flight, after being told it was going from a limited series to an ongoing series, is back to a limited series and ending with issue 8. And that's within like 2 weeks that was announced, which blows my mind how quickly something like that could flip around.
No, I completely agree with your analysis on this, Brett, that they are not interpreting this information properly, that they should be looking at the creations as being the ideas generators rather than an end in and of themselves.
And Disney, and the reason I don't think it's Disney and it's Perlmutter is because Disney's known for being really good towards its employees. Like, they supposedly have fantastic benefits, really good. I mean, from everything I've heard, is like just really good. They just treat their employees really well. Versus Marvel, which it sounds like supposedly a couple things from Disney trickled in, but for the most part, it's like really walled off. And locked down, which is kind of fascinating. And they were definitely profitable, but they didn't meet their projections. So I imagine Perlmutter, because it hasn't been long since it's, what, maybe the second quarter or third quarter since the buyout. If they're not meeting the projections, Perlmutter's probably flipping his shit, and that he's thinking if they don't meet the projections, Disney's going to start looking their way, and he and his control is going to start going bye-bye. So he's scrambling to try to make things look better than they really are.
And seriously, like, is letting go 27 people really going to make that difference in your bottom line?
No.
So much? Like, I don't get that. I don't see how those people's salaries were collectively enough to make the difference in the fact that not every American child reads comics.
So,
like, that's not going to balance that out.
So it's, what, 27 people. Let's say they make 50 grand. Three. So you're looking at $1.3 million for the year. Plus benefits,
yeah, nothing,
which,
right?
Yeah, for a company that got bought out for $4 billion, that's hardly anything.
Yeah, I mean, I joked in my blog post, if he cares so much, he could take a pay cut. That was my suggestion for how they could save money.
The dude supposedly made like $1 billion off the deal. He's one of the richest guys in the world. He should be taking no money. Should I have a salary?
Yeah. Well, you know, this goes to show yet again that it seems like a lot of the quote-unquote business minds in comics really don't have a clue. It's really sad. You know, on the one hand, you have DC, who thinks that the gateway to the future is repeating the 90s, platform shoes, broken-backed women with no personalities and all. And then, you know, Marvel, who thinks that letting go 27 staff people is what's going to make them profitable. Like, they're both just clueless.
Well, yeah.
And meanwhile, you know, nobody's using Google Analytics. Nobody's using
really
easy research tools to do any kind of targeted marketing. So pathetic and weird.
What kind of surprised me throughout all of it, and I just got a copy of Young Justice season 1 part 2 from Warner Brothers to review. And I've never seen the TV show before, and I'm reading, like, watched the first episode last night as I was going to sleep, and I was like, wow, this is really good. It's pretty entertaining. How come there's not really anything that translates this to comic books? And for Marvel, I'm thinking,
well, they had a Young Justice,
but it wasn't
series,
really,
I thought.
Yeah, but it wasn't really in continuity. Like, there's no Young Justice
right.
within continuity. There's a Young Justice series, but that's kind of unto itself. There's no, like...
But they also weren't advertising the series during the show. Like, they weren't. I mean,
yes.
Not that I sat around watching the episode, but I did catch a few episodes, and they weren't advertising their comic during it, so...
Well, that was actually what stood out to me. So I watched I popped the DVD in, and I went through the previews go through, because I was interested in seeing it, and it advertised the new Green Lantern animated series, which is cool. It advertised, I want to say, the Batman Year One DVD that just came out. There was like one or two other things that were DC cartoon series. But there was no advertisement for the comic book series. There was no advertisement for DC Comics, period.
And that's free. They couldn't be putting that advertisement in their own darn DVD for free.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Really
And I haven't looked at the extras, but I'm guessing there's no free like digital comic on it, which is another missed opportunity.
Oh yeah.
The one thing that I was thinking, and it kind of been running through it in my head, because so The Walking Dead second season started last week. I have more friends who talk about The Walking Dead more than anything else. Anything else when it comes to television, movies, like all these people are obsessed with The Walking Dead. And as soon as the second season started, on my Metro trip every day, like I'm seeing people reading The Walking Dead again. There is a clear crossover from people watching that television show to reading the comic book series and usually trade paperback is what I'm seeing. I don't see that with anything else. Anything else comic related is just like I'm not noticing it. So nothing when it comes to like television series, movies, none of that seems to cross over like this television series. It blows my mind. And it's like every single season. The first season was really apparent. Every single day I saw somebody usually going to work and coming back from work had a trade in their hand. And it's only been one episode, but I saw at least three or four people during the week reading the trade series.
That makes perfect sense to me, yeah.
So, I mean, we had the discussion with Ron, and he said that there was no crossover. A couple other people that I talked to said that there's no crossover. To me, that might be lightning in the bottle, but that shows there could be crossover. And the only thing I can think of is there is a definitive starting point with The Walking Dead. There's an easy part to like pick up and say, here's the first trade. This is where I'm going to start reading.
You know what I'm wondering? Are these people who don't read comics usually, but who end up reading them through their fandom for a different TV show or movie, do they buy them online? I mean, obviously they read them as trade paperbacks because only comics fans read comic issues. But do they buy the trade paperback online? Like, do they get them through Amazon? Is that how they end up owning them since they don't go to Forbidden Planet? Like, I'm curious about that. How do they get their hands on it, you know? I would start asking them on the street, frankly, if I have to start doing that, I guess.
Yeah, so my friends that I've talked to, a lot of them grab it from the library, which is very, very smart. And most that don't get it from the library either borrow it from someone else or pick it up on Amazon or, like, online.
Amazon,
they don't know where a comic book shop is.
Right. And they live in D.C., so they have them.
There's tons.
No, but
of course
it's Amazon.
But to me, like, it was quite fascinating to see that, is that, you know, it kind of goes back with Marvel where they've got these great properties and they've had, you know, fairly successful movies this year, but I didn't see an uptick of people reading Captain America, Thor, and X-Men like I do The Walking Dead.
Which is really unfortunate because I have to tell you, X-Men is amazing right now, as is Journey into Mystery, which is Thor's sort of home book, which has, of course, been low-key centered the past year or so. They're fantastic. I wish that people were... Well, I mean, X-Men is selling really well, cause, like, for any comic, but I definitely would wish that people had used this as an opportunity to promote those comics more. Have you been reading Journey into Mystery?
I have. I haven't gotten to this week's episode or issue, but it's been good. Like, I think we talked about it a little bit. Was my issue with the series is it's somewhat dense. Like there's a lot of machinations that Loki's doing, and he's really kind of scheming, and it's kind of hard to follow everything. But that was really kind of isolated Fear itself. So now it's done with Fear itself. I'm interested in seeing where it goes. But like the art's fantastic. I love the characterizations. It's a really solid
story. I was talking to Karen Gillan, who's the writer of that comic, about it, and I mentioned that one of my favorite things actually are the pages each in the front of each book where one of the characters sort of gives a summary of what happened in the last issue and sums up where things are now. And I was telling him how I thought those were wonderful, especially not this issue, but the one before, where the young girl from Hell, Leia, is talking about how she totally doesn't even like Loki at all, and he's not amusing, and that's why, and she's, you know, the way like little kids give each other grief about things and they secretly like each other. It was hilariously written, and he told me that actually the editorial staff are the ones who write those, so bravo to the editors on that book, because I think those are wonderful.
And hopefully they're not ones that have been shit-canned by Marvel.
I'm sorry?
I said hopefully they're not ones that have been shit-canned by Marvel.
Good point. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's been an interesting couple of weeks. I mean, the thing that kind of that caught me about New York Comic Con was the lack of big news.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
There was...
Oh, shit. Well, there's one thing. There's one... I mean, Phoenix.
Yes. Something is going on with Phoenix.
Phoenix will be back at some point.
Something is
going on. In my humble opinion, far sooner than it should be, but what you going to do, you know?
Well,
at least it's in the hands of some writers who I think are very talented.
In Regenesis, speaking of Phoenix, so Regenesis, there's a brief mention as to clearly that's what they're referencing about how Hope probably has this power that can destroy worlds, and it's best to not, and she doesn't realize it yet. And like Cyclops makes some comment of like, I'd rather have her close, and we probably shouldn't bring it up to her. And it's not really mentioned as it's Phoenix they're talking about, but. That's what they're hinting
at.
That's all. Yeah, it's again, Marvel seems to be coming back to the 90s as well. You've got Cable coming back in, like, January or February.
He's coming back? Darn it! I was so happy with him being dead. I've always hated Cable. I thought the way they killed him made really good sense. I mean, what, are they going to bring back Bishop now, too? I was really happy with how he died also.
Yeah, so the Cable thing looks interesting in that... He's got to come back and kill the Avengers for whatever reason.
What? Right now, you can't see it, but right now I'm clenching my teeth and grimacing and making my neck really wide.
Which kind of fits for Cable, since you'd be right now imitating a Rob Liefeld picture.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing.
But yeah, like he's coming back. They got Phoenix. And some of the other stuff, like coming out of Fear itself, is a whole bunch of other throwback series, like The Defenders coming back. But yeah, it's I think the 90s are back in a horrible, horrible way.
Wow, I didn't realize that the plague was so consistent. I mean, look, of course Phoenix is going to come back, and it should come back. It's the Phoenix. That's the theme. I would have given it more time. I think it gives... more gravitas to the story if there had been a longer period of time of Phoenixless X-Men. I mean, it seems like they're kind of not, I mean, Hope certainly looks like Jean, but she doesn't seem like Jean, so I don't think they're actually bringing her back, the Phoenix back as Jean, but maybe once Hope gets possessed with the Phoenix power full on, maybe she'll start acting all Jean-ish, and meanwhile Wolverine is naming the new school after Jean, and I don't know, really...
And even
don't
with X-Men, you've got two teams split off. Yeah, you've got like two teams split off, which was a 90s thing.
But that was different. The blue and gold team did not have ideological differences unless I missed something in there. Didn't pick up an issue.
The interesting was, if you looked at the advertising, one was advertised as blue, the other one was advertised as gold.
Spot that.
Yeah, and all the teasers, the logos were either like yellowish, which I take as gold, and then blue.
Yeah, but those are the X-Men colors. I mean, you know.
And
I get what you're saying, but I'm not ready to condemn this as being a blue team, gold team. Like, I think that the split makes sense based on, you know, the ideological thing. I loved how Beast was in the Regenesis book. Like, I was believing you before. It was cool. Oh, so fucking great.
I loved how he came back and he was like, I'm here so I can leave again, and just has that look like, F you. You're doing this wrong. You're, like, totally screwed up, and I don't want to deal with you.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I have to say, I kind of feel bad for Scott, but it was wonderfully done. So.
Yeah, and I'm kind of interested in seeing where they go. So, it's clear Mr. Sinister is going to be the first villain off for at least the Uncanny side of things.
Yes.
And then I have no idea what the hell to expect for Wolverine side of stuff.
Yeah, I bet that's more of the Sentinel stuff, since it clearly hasn't been resolved yet. The Hellfire Club kids and stuff. Interesting villain.
Hellfire kids?
The Hellfire kids, yeah. The Hellfire Club kids.
Yeah, and you know what, another interesting was off of Regenesis and Fear Itself. Both had this theme of weapons of mass destruction being like let loose in the world. Which I thought was two very interesting things to kind of hit at the same time, whether or not they outright meant to hit both of them at the same time, they did, was you had the Sentinels being used to basically as a defensive posturing against mutants in the world. And then you had, I mean, hell, even the Fear Itself follow-up, Captain America makes a comment. They said, I'm not letting these WMDs loose. Like, you guys screwed up. We're keeping them.
So is Thor dead or something?
Yes, Thor is dead, like, again.
It's okay. He's a Christ figure. He's allowed to come back. I mean, like, Thor actually is a Christ figure. So, like, the deity, so he predates whatever. It's fine. That can happen.
Yeah, and I imagine he'll be back for the Avengers movie next year, so.
Yeah, that seems pretty fast. I like when they keep people dead for a while. I'm fine with bringing things back when it makes sense, like if somebody's a Norse deity who's prone towards reincarnation, if someone's name is Phoenix, they're allowed to be brought back from the dead. But I do think you should give the death some time to have some significance before bringing something back so quickly.
Well, it seems about the Human Torch will be dead for just about a year before he comes back.
Is that for certain? We know that he's coming back right now. He's coming back now.
Well, Fantastic Four 600 comes up in fairly soon. They're all, I mean, they've been teasing it. So
I don't read Fantastic Four. I just, like, I don't know. There haven't been any writers on it I thought were particularly interesting for a while.
Yeah, well, unless you like Hickman, like, his stuff goes on, like, you have to read 20, 30 issues to get the full payoff. Like, his is a slow, laid-out, plotted read. I mean, it's probably been, I'm going to say, like, 20, 30 issues, 40 issues maybe at this point, and he's finally bringing plot threads together that he's been hinting
at. Well, maybe he'd be better to read in trade paperback.
He is. Like, Secret Warriors was one that he wrote.
Oh, that was by him. I need to read that. I haven't. I'd like to borrow that from someone. Any friends out there want to loan me a copy?
That was one that came towards the end that I was just like, holy shit. Especially towards the end of it, like the last quarter of it, really has this whole thing of like the UN Security Council finally getting wind of what the hell's going on. And they're pissed that Fury's just basically running the Shadow War. And there's a speech in there being like, we're doing what you're unwilling to do. And it's just one of those like chess game series that goes on and on and on. And I wonder what would have happened if he kept it going a little bit further. But I think the ending was a little rushed. But it was one that was like 28 issues. And by the end of it, you're like, holy crap, I can't believe he really actually pulled it off and tied all these things together. Hmm. But that's what his Fantastic Four has been like. It's just this plotting on and on series. And it's been fairly interesting. But, yeah, I mean, you've got Human Torch is, like, finally coming back. Captain America, they, like, left dead for a couple of years at least.
Not even. It was, like, a year, no?
No, I thought I'd say it was longer than that.
Mm.
It was 20, let's see here, it was 25. It died in issue 25. I want to say it came back about 50-something. So, yeah,
okay.
It was about at least 2 years.
Should have been dead longer. But, I mean,
then,
no, seriously. I mean, I think to truly respect the character's sacrifice and its significance, you need to feel a real loss.
Yes.
In order to feel a real loss, it needs to take real time.
Yes. But, I mean, in Brubeck, he kind of brought him back in an interesting way. Like, it didn't quite, it wasn't as convoluted as a lot of other things. I mean, Phoenix has been dead. Jean Grey's been gone how long? I want to say she's been dead, and I've been back reading comics for 5, 6 years.
Yeah.
She's dead for at least that long.
I would have given it a decade. And I say this as like a huge Jean Grey fan. I would have given her a decade of dead. That would make her coming back that much more, oh my God, significant.
I'm trying to think who else. There's been some interesting stuff. Like, you had Cedric back in a really kind of odd way. Apocalypse, they brought back in a interesting way for X-Force. But, yeah, I mean, it's...
Apparently is a book I should be reading and haven't.
X-Force?
Oh, my, I was going to say, my favorite bit of X-Men news that I learned at Comic-Con, actually, I've been talking about this. Apparently Marjorie Liu is going to be doing a Gambit miniseries. Now, I really like her stuff, especially I loved Black Widow. And in fact, as soon as she stopped writing it, I stopped buying it because it wasn't any good after she left. But I'm not a huge fan of Gambit as a character, even frankly. But I do think that that's a great combination. Her writing style with that character will work really well. Gambit is a very popular character among the ladies, and having a woman writing it is a good match. I bet that that's a kind of comic that you could easily get your female friends who've read X-Men before but haven't picked it up for a long time to pick up.
That's a good comic
for the industry.
Yeah, her X-23 has been really good.
I've liked that as well.
It's kind of been up and down, and some arcs aren't as good as others, but as a whole, I like what she's doing with the character. She's grown the character enough that it's not just like a Wolverine and skirt knockoff.
Which is seemingly a terrible idea in and of itself, so I'm glad to see her do that.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of brought back, when the character started, it was like, hey, it's a Wolverine clone who was a kid prostitute and was abused and all this stuff, and she's like picked up a little bit of that, but not harping on it, but gives a hint that, yeah, there's these scars underneath, and she's really unsure of herself, and at the same time, it's not throwing out there, being like, she was a prostitute, she was, but like, that's not brought up every issue, but at least her, you can see that the character is, like, wounded and, broken in some way.
I mean, from what I've seen, she seems like a reasonable teenager. She seems like a good job writing a teenager,
Yes. Yeah. A teenager who's been abused and isn't sure of her place in the world.
And none of them are, even if they haven't been abused, that's the nature of teenagerness. So
right, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy about that series coming out, and it seemed like they got a lot of buzz when I was at Comic Con. It's a really good move, so.
And Gambit,
I applaud you, Marvel, on that decision.
And Gambit's been in X-23, so she's got some...
Yes, she's... some stuff working with him already, yeah. His costume's still stupid, so hopefully somebody can fix that.
Yeah, I still don't quite get
it. It's not as stupid as it was. Because he really had pretty much one of the stupidest costumes of the 90s. But 80s, 90s as well. But, it's still stupid. Sorry, guys.
But, yeah, there was, like, a lack of news from Marvel and DC at Comic-Con. It was all kind of indies that try to break some news, and even then it wasn't anything major. Dark Horse announced a lot of new series. Image scored the next Brubaker Sean Phillips series, which is going to be awesome. And I think that was, to me, like the biggest news, because you'd think that they would be producing that under Icon and Marvel, but they're not. They jumped the ship, Image.
Who is?
Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, who have been doing Criminal. And Criminal is being produced under the Marvel print Icon. They're doing a new series called Fatale, and it's all going to be done printed under Image, which is pretty interesting that Image got that. So I can't tell if maybe Image came to them with a better deal to get it printed or what, but to me that was like one of the biggest news, that basically Marvel lost the next series of like their top two talent. At least one of their best writers and one of their best artists. And then I'm trying to think.
I was excited to hear about the new team on Conan for Dark Horse.
Yeah, I was about to say that was part of the Dark Horse thing, was they announced Brian Wood and Becky Cloonan for the new Conan series, which should be really interesting. Because that's the team that was doing Northlanders, right?
Yep.
I mean, Wood was writing. Cloonan, I think, was doing the art.
I haven't been reading Northlanders, but I think that's the case.
Yeah, it's a Viking series that fits Conan, so if that Conan is anything like Northlanders, it's going to be amazing.
And, he's also just known to be a really great writer, and she's known to be a really great artist, so definitely looking forward to seeing that.
And then
I'm sure the Conan movie was so terrible, because that would have been a really great tie-in for everything, but the movie was so bad, we can only hope that people don't make a connection. Maybe people will just think back to the Schwarzenegger movie from the 80s, which is fantastic.
And that's one that it's come out on Blu-ray, and I've been told a million times I need to pick it up for the commentary alone on Blu-ray.
Yes. Oh, yes. No, you have to do it. You have to do it.
Trying to think what else.
Well, my bit of news that I got, and isn't even comic related, because, it's from the press junkets I went to, one with Pendleton Ward and some of the actors, voice actors from Adventure Time, said they are going to have another gender-switched episode in the future, which is very exciting. A lot of fans really enjoyed that. Definitely cemented for me that this is actually one of the best cartoons in terms of its portrayal of the female characters that I've seen on television in a very long time, and it's also just wonderful in general. So that's my little bit of news that maybe I'm breaking. Who knows? We'll see. For all of you Adventure Time fans watching Cartoon Network, likely.
I'm trying to think. For me, I went to that DC talent panel that you told me to go to.
Mm-hmm.
It literally was a talent panel in that it was like, if you have art that you want us to look at, this is the process that you go through. So there was no discussion in the, like, this is what we're really, well, they kind of discussed what they're looking for, but it wasn't a discussion about talent, like, behind the scenes. It was just there's a whole bunch of you here that want to break into the industry. This is how you go about it to get us to look at your stuff at this convention.
Time there.
No, it was interesting. It was pretty fun to kind of watch all these people who were artists showing each other their work, and I'm kind of looking at it. I'm like, now, like, this person might be able to pull it off. No way in hell this person's going to pull it off. So I was kind of looking at that. So that was fairly interesting. And then I went to the Kickstarter panel, which was actually really kind of fun, which had a bunch of people go over how they've used Kickstarter to raise funds to get their comic series published, and it gave like some stats, some what works. Everyone kind of talked about their successes. So that was actually, it was a pretty interesting panel just to kind of hear what everyone's thoughts were. And then I think later that day I went to the Comixology panel, which was the last panel I went to really listen to. I thought it was going to be them kind of, you know, puffing their chest, being like, we're the king of the mountain. And it wasn't. They actually just, the two founders of the company just sat on stage and took basically questions and abuse from the audience. They just opened it up and it was like, what questions do you guys have? What concerns do you have? And that was pretty interesting because they were even throwing up there like, hey, do you guys like this function? And people were responding of like, we use it this way. And they're just like, you could see the look on their faces like, oh, we haven't thought of that. So that was pretty interesting doing that. And then Saturday I tried to go to panels, but it was a shit show. I tried going to the Archie panel, but the line was three times longer than the size of the room. And then, I mean, I have photos and video of it. Like, it's just wall-to-wall people where the panels were. So that was probably my only negative thing about the entire show was they need to figure out something better for panels next year.
Yeah, I wasn't able. I mean, I'm glad I was able to go to that press hour for Adventure Time because the regular open panel to the public, my boyfriend tried to get into that and you couldn't even get near the room and he'd gone early. So I heard a lot of people not getting into gaming, being able to get into things they wanted to get into.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I think like it was packed. Like there was not one panel. Friday you could walk in and out. That like there was no problem whatsoever. Saturday just was crazy. And the thing was the floor wasn't a problem at all, which was absolutely amazing. Because if you think panels are that bad, I had no problems with the floor.
I didn't make it out to Artist Alley till Sunday, so this might not actually be true. But it looked to me that there were fewer artists this year, and that made me very sad. Did it seem thin to you at all?
I'm trying to think. I want to say it was probably about the same size. Might have been a little bit smaller, but for the most part, I think it was about the same size. It was a different location. It was on, like, if you're facing into the convention center, it was on the left last year. It was on the right this year. There was more non-artist-related stuff this year. I think the difference might have been was more, they might have had small publishers mixed in a little bit more that last year than this year. But I want to say like just artist tables, it was still pretty packed. I actually had fun this year. Was kind of cool. Was Charles Soleil, who I became friends with, has done 27 for Image, Strongman for Slave Labor, is I think it was Slave Labor. He kept on leaving his table, and I walked by, and there was people checking out his table, and I became friends with him in Baltimore like 2 years ago. So I texted him. I was like, there's people at your table. You want me to kind of hop behind for a little bit? And I wound up working his table a bunch on Saturday, which was fun, just being on the other side of the table talking to comic fans about why, like, they like what they like and pitching them Charles's comic book series. And it was just, to me, it was a lot of fun. And fairly interesting to be on that other side of the table trying to pitch things to people who either don't care whatsoever or people who are really, really excited. So that was part of how I spent my Saturday.
That's neat. I actually ended up bringing, you'd be very proud of me, some independent, very small, like self-published independent-type comics, including one about the War of 1812 that I'm looking at right now, called The Locksleys and the War of 1812, which presents a Canadian perspective on the war, which, of course, is not the one I was taught as a child, written by Alan Grant, if you'll remember from back in the day, as well as some new guys, Claude St. Aubin, Lover, and Ken Jerski, and Todd Klein, which looks like an interesting, you know, comic history comic for, you know, older kids, I would say. And I like that it's a perspective that's a Canadian one, specifically.
My pickups were, I got a bunch of things from Arkea, which are always, like, fantastic to hook me up. But I picked up Action Philosophers, who I've heard, like, amazing things about, by Van Lent and Dunleavy. And they're supposed to be doing, like, a follow-up called Action Presidents, which is, like, a superhero team of presidents, yeah. So I picked that up. It looks awesome. And then the one I liked that I've been waiting forever is called, it was called American Terrorists, made its debut at New York Comic Con. And it was interesting. Like, it's not a series I thought it would be. I reviewed the first two chapters already on the site and then finished reading the entire thing on the way back. So I need to write up the rest of it. But, it was a pretty interesting series in that basically what I thought it was going to be was just like a comic about like a terror cell in the U.S. and what drove these people to being a terror cell. But instead it's more of like, here's three people who all were actually innocent people and due to the way the system is done are kind of drawn into being terrorists through kind of a series of errors. Which was a very interesting, different take on it.
That's interesting, yeah.
It was good. Like, the art was pretty solid. I mean, I read through it. I was like, all right, you know, totally cool, worth it. I'm trying to think what else. That was it. I mean, a lot of the things were, a lot of people I saw were the same folks that I saw at Baltimore, SPX, and San Diego. So I think that was the big difference for me for this year at New York was our, having been to everything previously, I pretty much saw everything earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, I mean, it's actually met, I think it's Pal Schmidt, his name, is a comic writer, did Devil's Concubine for IDW, and it was fun talking to him. It was actually probably one of the cooler things of New York was we wound up talking about the death threats towards the Denmark artists for their depiction of Mohammed.
Oh, yeah.
And he's actually from Denmark.
Oh.
So he was giving that perspective and filling me in on the background of all that. And all the stuff that like the news sources weren't covering.
Right.
Which made me go back and really want to check out more of what was going on. It was actually a really, really cool conversation. And it was just fun talking to him. He's, I think we talked for probably an hour at least. And that was one of the cooler things, I think, of the show. And other than that, like, yeah, it was a fairly uneventful show.
Yeah, I need to write up some of my notes from the panels I attended. But, you know, people at the, let's give Didio and Lee Grief for being idiots panel. They definitely pat themselves on the backs quite a bit, but they also got questions from the audience, both, you know, giving them grief over Starfire and for being unwelcoming to women fans for those reasons. A man in the audience called them out on making, you know, what happened to Oracle and making Barbara Gordon no longer be handicapped, and, you know, Didio apparently has a sister who's in a wheelchair, but the way he narrated that response was so nonsensical, I was literally incapable of taking notes on it. Like, I'm like, I don't see what his point is. I think he might be babbling, and we're done. Like, it was really weird and was weak. But what was amazing was that the way that they talked about, like, when people criticized the sexism, his response is like, oh, well, not all comics are going to be liked by all people. Wow, that's, like, not even the point. Like, I'm not saying, oh, you should only do horror comics, you should only do comedy, or you should only do comics for adults, you should only do comics for kids. Like, doing sexist comics is not cool, period. You know, I think that perhaps he only understood the part of about the Starfire complaint that dealt with it being stupid for them to take a character that kids, that children liked, and to make it something that children couldn't read. It feels like he only heard that part of it and, like, doesn't get the whole, you know, personality-wiped robot who's being only treated as a sex object in condescending ways. Like, he missed huge sections of the problem in the first place in his answer. And then they talked about, oh, well, you can't dial down creativity. I'm sorry, what does that even mean? It has nothing to do with being sexist and being assholes and how you portray women in your comics. Like, there's some weird disconnect. I don't know.
What does that even mean?
Good. I think that he thinks that he's Neil Gaiman writing Sandman in the 80s, and that we're the concerned parents of America. I think he thinks he's making some high comics art that is going to touch on some subjects and deal with some themes that are too heavy for children and are taking comics to a darker place. And that we, the fans, are acting like the concerned parents of America who are like, no, comics offer children and they should be light and funny. It's like, no, we wish you were Neil Gaiman making Sandman in the 90s because that shit was brilliant. No, you're making shit that's just sexist and inexcusable and stupid, and we're complaining about that. I think he thinks he's defending high art.
Yeah, but it's not. Like, that was my issue, wasn't it? With those comics was, it wasn't necessarily the sex and or the violence or anything. It was just bad writing. Forget, like, the how Starfire was depicted, how Catwoman was. It was bad writing. Like, it wasn't even a decent comic to begin with.
I definitely heard that from a lot of fans as well.
So, I mean, to me, it's like, that is even almost beside the point. Like, whoever okayed this and said, hey, this is a coherent and decent comic, is high as a kite. It was just not good to begin with. So, I mean, I can almost see them getting defensive. I wasn't there. Well, one, I have to applaud DC for the intelligence of putting that panel on Sunday late afternoon when most of the people are going to be gone. brilliant move on their part. No one else called them out on that. I saw that so transparent. So bravo to them. The only thing better would have been to do it in a really small room. Until when people have been in there. So that's the first. It was just bad. It was bad writing.
Yeah, that whole panel and that whole situation just felt really awkward and nasty, and like nobody felt. I shouldn't project what others in the room felt, but there was just a general like pall over everything in there. And I would contrast that to the X Books panel that I went to immediately following the DC one, and all the ex-writers and artists, you know, and editors were on the stage. They all had a great dynamic with each other. You could tell they really liked each other, and the fans were having a good time with it, and it just had a completely different tone, than the DC room did.
Well, DC, I can see them taking the stance of, we sold whatever, a couple millions books. I think they sold like 5 million or 2 million, whatever it was. Comic books and our shit don't stink at this point. We see them taking that stance, and I'm sure that's where they're coming from right now, being like, yeah, all these people hate it, but it still sold 200,000 copies. And it's like, great, so it sold 200,000 copies. What's the second issue selling? What's the third issue selling? What's the fourth issue selling?
Yeah.
People want.
And is anybody ever going to read this ever again? Is it good enough to actually be I mean, some of the issues are, but a lot of it is just.
Yeah, and you know, people of course will check out the car wreck, but they're not going to sit there and keep on paying $4 to check the car wreck or check out the car wreck every single month. Like sooner or later, you're going to say this is a joke and give up on it. And
yeah.
A lot of those series, I think that's going to be it. And even me going through a lot of these second issues so far of these past 2 weeks, I was like, you know, these are good. But this isn't strong enough to, I think, like, DC is not going to wind up in the same place 6 months from now.
Right.
So I'm interested in seeing, and I fully expected them at New York to come out and be like, here's the second wave of series that are going to come out, which is kind of funny that you call it the New 52, yet clearly there's going to be more than 52 comics. But I fully expected that, and then going into it, I was like, you know what? It's not smart of them to do that. Like, they should wait off so when they start axing comics, they're quickly going to pop it up and being like, yeah, this series got canceled. Hey, look at the new shiny object. We're doing this new series to try to distract people, which is my thought is why they probably weren't announcing things at New York, which would have been smart strategy, but I don't know if I'm giving them too much credit to think those things through.
Yeah, they're probably giving too much credit. You know, we should. Did you pick up Huntress? That was one of the new post 52.
Yeah, I didn't, and I've heard nothing but good things on it.
Pick it up. It's good. It's not. I mean, look. Every time I read any character that was in Birds of Prey, makes me sad that Gail Simone isn't writing it right now. You know, but it was good. I mean, to the extent that. I guess my standards are too low because I was like, oh, good, this isn't sexist and terrible in any way, shape, or form. Helena's armor makes sense. She's capable and interesting. You know, like, Huntress was good, but it wasn't great. I mean, if I wasn't currently having such a moment of loss of faith in how mainstream comics are dealing with women right now, I might not have even picked it up. I feel like I'm practically picking it up to encourage their good behavior, you know. But I like, you know, but it was pretty good. It was pretty good.
Did you read the second issue of Batgirl?
I did.
What did you think of it?
Well,
I think that says a lot right there.
I mean, I love Gail, obviously. I love Gail Simone so much. Again, it's not bad. It's good, but she's done so much more brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's better than most comics by far, easily. I know she can do better.
It wasn't as good, I think, as the first issue. I think the things I liked of it, and it seemed like a lot of the issues from last week, I was on the same thing where, like, half of it's really good, and then the other half I kind of was like, blah. But Batgirl, like, I liked the post-traumatic issues that she's having from being shot. Like, that's really
that's
good.
Interesting, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it makes it like, you know, hey, this person pointed a gun at her. You know, what's going to happen in the future when she's put in that situation? Is she going to freeze? Like, that's really good. But the bad guy, I was kind of like, whatever. With Batman and Robin was a similar thing. Like, I love the dynamic of Bruce and Damian and how Bruce doesn't know how to be a father. And Damian definitely doesn't know how to be a kid. And he's sitting there being like, wow, this kid's really messed up. And I got to figure out how to write him before he kills someone. But then again, the villain, I was just like, what the hell, doesn't matter to me. And then Batwoman, like, the art I thought was absolutely amazing. The story,
gorgeous.
Yeah, gorgeous, like, layouts, everything, absolutely amazing. But the story, I was just like, ho-hum, it's good, it's not great.
I mean, the story in Batwoman isn't as good as the art. However, I would argue that that's because the art is probably the second best comic art I've ever seen. So...
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to skew. I'm still enjoying Batwoman a great deal, and not just for the insanely gorgeous art.
So Batwoman, a great series that kind of reminds me of is it was another Jonathan Hickman one, was Nightly News, which came out years ago, and I think it's being reissued in a 10th anniversary. That was another one that I read that the way the layouts were done and the art was so different for the time, and it's still so different that it really made me almost re-envision what a comic could do visually. And that's what Batwoman is like that second issue where there's the page that's basically a two-page spread but done in panels of the Bat logo, and she's talking to Batman, like, it's just amazing. Like, all of it is absolutely amazing. I can't even describe how unbelievable the series is as far as just visually.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. I definitely use one of the comics I wave around at my friends who don't read comics. Be like, ooh, look at the pretty.
Yeah, but most of the second issues, I was just kind of like, yeah, these are good. Nothing really stood out at all to me so far.
I'm still really enjoying Demon Knights. I'm going to acknowledge that you're right, that it is like a D&D campaign, but I'm really enjoying it.
I will, you know what, I will check out the trade when the trade comes out.
Okay.
I will absolutely do that. I'll give it a shot.
I'm loving the Art and Swamp thing. Didn't find second issue as good, as interesting in the story as the first. I think that the scene and what they're talking about is interesting, but I felt like I knew what was going to happen the whole book. I don't know. What did you think of issue two?
Swamp Thing was interesting in that I liked how it's one side of the story, the Animal Man's the other side of the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That makes it very interesting to me. As a whole, though, it was good. Like, I know Snyder's writing. I like his style. It's usually slow burn, and you don't get a payoff until the fourth or fifth issue. So that's just his writing style. And me going back and forth with him, that we've talked about this, he admitted that's kind of his style, and that, you know, it takes adjustment because, you know, comics tend to be very, like, here's the payoff within one issue, and we're going to have the big, shocking ending. His isn't like that. It's just a really slow build. So if you go in that way, like, I think his stuff probably reads better in trade than it does necessarily as individual issues. But yeah, I mean, it was good. Like, I liked Swamp Thing. I didn't think it was as good as the first issue, but it was still good. Animal Man, I thought, was still really good. Even though it kind of, like, I felt like I was dropping acid reading it.
Oh, that sounds like fun. No. My store was sold out of Animal Man. I would have picked it up otherwise.
I'm trying to think what else. As a whole, like, I think I'm at half of the comics that started. I've dropped half of them. I'm going to probably drop another six of them after this month.
Wonder Woman. Did you pick up Wonder Woman?
I haven't had a chance to read it. That's on a to-read tonight, hopefully. Did you read it yet?
Yes. It's good. I mean, the art is wonderful. Really, really strong art. The story's good. It's interesting. Yeah, you know, I'm not sitting here being like, oh my god, I can't wait for the next issue about any of the DC comics right now. Somebody told me that, like, Wonder Woman or Demon Knights or, you know, one of the other books I'm enjoying was going to be discontinued, I'd be disappointed. I really would be, and I'd be like, oh, darn it, I really wanted to, you know. But I'm not sitting here being like, oh my god, I wonder what's going to happen next. I'm so looking forward to this. Please take my money. Like, I'm not having that reaction, really.
Yeah, none of it I am. I'm doing that, too.
I'm feeling that way about Uncanny, though. I mean, I've been feeling that way about Uncanny and what Karen Gillan's been doing over in X-Men, you know, period. So it's not that I'm not capable of having those feelings. I most certainly am. You know, I'm almost approaching, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire, George R. R. Martin levels of, let me read it now, obsession over the X-Books today. So.
Yeah, I mean, the Batman that I read earlier today, and it was good. I don't think it was as good as the first issue. I actually thought Captain Atom was a better second issue than it was in the first issue. That was so far the only one that I picked up that I was like, this is actually improved compared to the first. But other than that, like, yeah, and like, none of the series have got me to the point where I have to sit there and be like, I need to read this every single week. Which to me is just not a good sign for DC. Like, as a comic book fan, if I'm not excited to check things out every single week.
On its own merit, yeah.
You know, I can't imagine Joe Schmo walking off the street is going to be excited like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're both DC fans, so it's very strange.
I'm trying to, yeah, I mean, that's it, really. Like, there, the one series from DC I'm looking forward to is the Fable spinoff, and that's about it. Like, that's, it's a pretty, I don't know, this, to me, the future of comics is a big, huge question mark right now. Yeah. I have no idea what to expect in the future. There's some great indie stuff coming out. The main two kind of just seem to be chugging along, but aren't really shaking things up as much as they probably should.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of is. So I think that's why the way I felt walking out of New York too was, it just is.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly was less exciting than the other things I was doing, you know, occupying Wall Street and whatnot. So, yeah, I was a less exciting Comic-Con at the end of the day. And and with the exception of the action books I was talking about, I'm not sitting here, like, on the edge of my seat. Can't wait to read the next thing about any of the other books that have been really coming out, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that I've been digging, I've been enjoying a lot of the preview stuff they've been sending. I got, I'm trying to think. I mean, there's some stuff that's really stood out just because it's original, like Monocyte, which came out from IDW.
What's that?
It's, so I don't even know how to describe it. It's like Hellraiser done by H.R. Giger with a Bible twist.
Okay.
That's the only way I can describe it. The art is, like, beyond gorgeous. If you dig Geiger's art in that, like, disgusting, beautiful sort of way, that's what the series is like visually. And if it's got 20 words in the entire first issue, I'd be shocked. It's like, I kind of even said it in the review of it, was it's like the minimal comic in that there's hardly any words in it. But the art is just beyond gorgeous and so different and so, I mean, it's amazing to look at. But the story, I kind of was in, like, the review, I was like, the story's not the point of it, it's the art. And even the people who
right.
were, I got one response from one of the people involved with it, and they're just like, you know, I was kind of dead on it, and that it was like a minimal story, that the focus is really visual in the storytelling. So that was very interesting to read. There's a new 30 Days a Night, which I'd never really read the comics beforehand, which I read the first issue, thought it was kind of fun. Ghostbusters seems to actually be fairly entertaining, even though it's a property, and I'm not usually the biggest fan of comic properties. Orchid, which I know came up in a lot because of Tom Morello and Occupy Wall Street and the fact that it was yet another odd depiction of a prostitute, I thought was pretty decent, was for the first issue. I'm trying to think.
I skimmed it in the store. I didn't really read it. They sort of skimmed it in the store. I think he kind of invents an interesting world.
Yes.
It's
not original. Like, it's very Gladiator at points, and I'm trying, Mad Max. It's like Mad Max and Gladiator mixed together with
yeah.
a prostitute as the lead. But it was, I thought his interview, I forgot who it was, Alyssa that did an interview.
Alyssa, yeah, it was Alyssa.
It was
good
really
interview.
Good.
Folks should definitely check it out. Mm-hmm.
And the others, I think.
On Think Progress's blog,
yeah.
Folks, you should go to Think Progress's blog and click for Alyssa for her comment. Well, one, everybody should be reading her anyway, but two, yeah, check out her interview with Tom Morello about Orchid. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and I think he actually kind of defends, like, his writing, that she's a prostitute and all that, and to hear his perspective was made me kind of go back and be like,
yeah.
Oh, it's kind of interesting to read it that way.
It's funny because she's like, why did you feel like writing about from this perspective? And he's like, basically like, I actually know people and I'm doing field work. And I was like, oh, okay. Well.
Yeah.
I know, and it wasn't that I thought that there was like, it just seemed like, if you're going to do this, you need to really understand it. And it's not something you choose to frame in that way lightly for kicks or for shocks. You know what I mean? And it looks like he did it genuinely and with seriousness and interest rather than, you know, which is really what it was really important, I think. But
yeah.
I haven't really read it thoroughly, so I can't offer my own opinion.
It's not great. It's good though. I'm trying to think what else. That's actually the one, and I kind of brought it up in the when I was rambling 2 weeks ago. The one that's blowing me away is Transformers of all things. I have to, so I got to send you these two issues. It's issue 22 and 23. It's up to issue 28. And
you promise me that it isn't just Optimus Prime and blowing himself up.
No, so this is what the two issues about, and you can tell me if it intrigues you at all. So it's the perspective of Megatron and how he got to where the way he is. He basically just like gives up and winds up turning himself in. And the two issues is basically him and Optimus just talking about their history together. Megatron like started off as a pacifist and writes a treatise of like this is what government should be, and that the government of Cybertron was corrupted and it needed to have a revolution and democracy needed to be put in, or at least a benevolent dictatorship, something beyond of what it is because it was beyond corrupt. And then he winds up in a fight and gets thrown in jail, which makes him a little bit more militant. And that's what the two issues about. It's just these two guys who really start from the same spot of whereas Megatron kind of saw it earlier that the Senate is corrupted. Optimus eventually discovers that the Senate is corrupted, and they kind of have this divergent path as to how to fix the corruption. And it's these two very political paths that are just drawn. And to me, it's like these two issues are some of the two best things I've read of the year.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll read them and I'll pretend that they're not robots, and then I think it'll be okay.
Yeah, well, that was kind of thing. It was like, this is really, because it's so off from everything else. I mean, generally the series is, yes, very much robots shooting at each other. But this was just there's scenes where they're debating back and forth. And, like, there's one part where Optimus makes a comment of, like, you know, what type of world would you have created? And he was just, and Megatron's just like, one where I ruled and everyone could make a decision for themselves, but I still rule. And whereas Optimus is like, I want a world where there is no classes and people can make choices for themselves, and what you are and how you look doesn't determine where, you know, what your life is going to be like. And it's just laid out between the two. It's absolutely fascinating, beyond fantastic.
I mean, I guess I've never really asked myself, what is giant robot's motivation? I suppose this will be my opportunity to consider that.
I will, since we have preview copies, I will send you the two. It's pretty impressive. I kind of walked away being like, holy shit, this is really, really good. The rest of the series quickly pivoted back to big giant robots shooting each other. But those two issues...
Yay, no.
You know,
no, I've never been a big fan of the property. I mean, I had some Transformers as a kid, but I've never willingly watched any of the movies. I've never really been particularly fond of them, even though I had Starscream when I was little. Back when they were made out of metal and were highly dangerous.
Yes, back to the days when they were actually metal figures.
Yeah.
I'm trying. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, there's just a lot coming out. Nothing's quite blowing me away, but there's some pretty solid work, I think, overall.
Do you have anything else we wanted to hit up today?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything we wanted.
Cool. I promise you guys I'll write up from the Cartoon Network panels that I attended for the blogs. You guys can take a look over those. And I know that isn't usually a beat for the show itself, so I'll just be posting those to Graphic Policy.
Yes, and I need to write up my panels that I attended to. I've been, unfortunately, lots of work this week, so very little original writing. But yeah.
Well, thanks for listening this week, everyone. We'll be back next week?
Yes, absolutely.
Sounds like a plan.
Cool. And hopefully I will send you those Transformers issues and you can see if I'm full of it.
Like an informed conversation about the robots.
There's going to be, I think, four comics I'm going to wind up sending you. Those two Transformers one, Cold War, which came out this week, which is interesting. It's, I think, IDW, John Byrne, basically doing a Cold War spy comic.
Oh, this one's cool.
Yeah, which was its first issue was really interesting, and then Pigs Number Two, which I
that's exciting.
Need to resend. That came out I think last week. That I need to send it to you. I thought I did, but clearly I didn't. Yeah, so we'll have a lot to discuss for next week.
And hopefully Kenneth will be able to join us again.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, we'll see you same bat radio channel. Hanging my head in shame for the lack of originality of my sign-off.
Same bat time, same bat channel.
Yeah. Have a great week, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks, bye.